This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and you're listening to WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman produces. Hi, it's John Williams, and thanks for joining us. We're here till 1 o'clock every Monday through Friday. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. John DeGerian joins us. What's today? Tuesday? It's kind of it's time to remember the days of the week, John. The holidays are over now. It's Tuesday. It is the 5th of January, and Mr. DeGerian joins us again. Hi, John. Welcome back.
Well, welcome back to you as well, John.
Yeah.
And the market's kind of all over the place today as well.
You had the founder of MarketRebellion.com, the financial news, education, and subscription site. What are you talking about there? All over. What are you seeing?
Well, there's been a little nervousness, as there is at the beginning of every year, quite frankly, even when many of us are saying the market, once we get the rollout of the vaccines, there's going to be this roaring 20s effect that will certainly, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a division of investment bankers or anything else that doesn't believe that we will see dramatic surges in Las Vegas, in hotel bookings, travel, and the like. And that's a tremendous thing, and we all want to be out of the pandemic. But there were a lot of people that had tremendous gains last year in the stock market, many of which, like I say, every year, they try to carry over into the new year without paying the tax that would be due in 2021 for anything that they sold, or if it was a short sale, that they bought back in 2020. So the fact that we run into that sort of thing at the first few weeks of every year is not a surprise, John. But it was somewhat dramatic yesterday because we went from up 100 in the Dow to down 700 in the Dow in an hour and a half. And that was almost all profit-taking from positions that they'd held, those people that were lucky enough to hold them last year. Mm-hmm. And then we've done a mini version of that again today, except now we're rolling back to the upside with the Dow up 130 and the NASDAQ up 0.5%.
You know, I've heard people refer to the Roaring Twenties, and we hope that we have something akin to that in the 20s of 2020 plus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the analogy because the Roaring Twenties to me were a run up to 1929, and the 30s were bad.
So well, that's true, and there were textbooks written about why that was bad. It wasn't that the 20s were bad. It was that the draconian measures that were foisted on folks during the time when the recovery was, you know, just getting started, really dumped us back into the downside that we didn't break out of until the late 30s, basically, into World War II.
Yeah, right.
So, World War II. But there are a host of other reasons, of course. I mean, again, if we want to say draconian, what about, you know, the Treaty of Versailles and what it did to the Germans, which are still, even today, one of the most powerful economic drivers in the world. And they were hit so hard with measures after World War I that some deemed that it was, you know, fair game to hit them that hard, that a Deutschmark went to a trillion to the dollar during that time. So we crushed them so hard that they had no choice almost except to fight. And, we are not faced with that same issue today. Instead, it's a virus we're fighting, not somebody that we wanted to get some retribution from for starting a world war.
Yeah. What do you think of what's happening in Georgia today? And if the Senate flips, will that change things this week or this year?
It would. Although the margin in either case, let's take, if you say it's a Republican win, which is what the markets believe it will be and what polling says, then they'll have a 52-48 majority. That's still very slim, with several Republicans, like the senator from Maine, and Murkowski and so forth. There's a lot of wiggle room there that doesn't really give you that hard 52-48 majority. And on the other hand, if it is, if both seats went to the Democrats in Georgia, you'd still have a split Senate, with the tiebreaker, of course, being the vice president and Kamala Harris. And again, either way, we're not likely to see any of the things that people either rooted for or were worried about with a blue wave. It's not the same thing at all right now.
You don't think that there will be another $2,000 stimulus check?
I think there might have to be, or I think even more likely, John, there will have to be not so much the $2,000 stimulus check discussion again, but getting the rollout has been so broken. Some of that, of course, coming because the rollout came during the holiday and Christmas and New Year and everything else, weekends and so forth. There were a lot of things, I think, that have caused the rollout of the vaccine to be less than stellar. Only 3.5 or 4 million Americans out of all the doses that are out there have been vaccinated. But I think that will pick up dramatically, but we might need more money. California, I saw that Gavin Newsom's asking his state for $300 million for the vaccine rollout, and I don't think he will be alone in that. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of that in the most recent stimulus bill, but I think there'll be more likely that we see even more money given to the states with that specific goal of vaccination of the populace.
Oil is above $50, or at least it crept to past $50. Is that significant? And should we be paying attention to that as sort of a sign as to what's to come?
Yes. I know you're putting the words in my mouth, so I'll be happy to spit them back to you. What John's, I think, leading me to, folks, is if crude oil is doing what it's doing and Brent and WTI both are moving higher, somewhat dramatically higher today, with energy being an outperforming sector, doesn't that mean that we're likely to see the vaccines result in increased demand? And my answer to that would be yes, that we are anticipating that increase in demand from air travel, from cruise ships and cargo ships moving more frequently. And I think that all is something that we're looking forward to. We're not looking forward to the higher prices of those, but certainly crude oil at over 50 hasn't been there since February. So it's a 5% move in WTI crude today. Mm-hmm. I think that's implying that we're going to see that the light at the end of the tunnel isn't a train.
Well put. One last thing. Any stocks mm-hmm. that have caught your eye today or this week? What are you looking at, John?
I'll just say quickly, John, that those Chinese stocks, in particular the ones that the New York Stock Exchange backpedaled on delisting, China Mobile, China Telecom, and so forth, CHL, CHU, those stocks, there were three of them on the New York Stock Exchange that all fell dramatically when, under an executive order, it looked like they would be forced to delist. Treasury turned it around, and the New York Stock Exchange said late last night, we're not going to delist these stocks then, and they're running today. So I'd say anything in the China sector, JD hit an all-time high, symbol JD, and Baba, Alibaba, I don't think Jack Ma's dead or in prison. I think he's just laying low because he realizes that perhaps he rattled the cage of that dragon instead of a tiger. He rattled the dragon's cage a little too much, and China will rattle back if you rattle them. So I think Jack Ma and Alibaba are going to do very well if he plays ball again with China.
John Najarian is the founder of MarketRebellion.com. Okay, John, nice to hear your voice, my friend. Stay well.
Likewise. You too, Steve. John, thank you.
I'll tell Steve you said hi.
Please do.
Yeah, okay. I saw him. He was back after a break just the other day, and he and I bumped into each other in the hall for the first time. John's done more shows with Steve Bertrand than he has with me, and you'll hear Chicago's Afternoon News with Steve a little after 3 this afternoon, a little after 4 on WGN. I called into that show yesterday. They were talking about birding. And my family, don't tell anybody this, but we're thinking about getting into it. And I had questions about binoculars and hats. And if you're interested in that, you should go to WGNradio.com. Dave Deschamps joins us now, wealth manager and head of the Widows Practice Group. This is interesting. I'll give you the website in a minute. It's got some letters that sound similar, so be ready to write it down. And Dave, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, John.
Let's talk about the widow's tax penalty. I read that 80% of wives outlive their husbands. I guess that sounds about right, huh?
Statistically, right? And we all know, we don't know how long we have on this earth, but statistically, 80% of wives will outlive their husbands.
Yeah.
And so this widow's tax penalty that we talk about here at BDF and one of the latest articles that Jenny Chung wrote for our firm talks about the fact that there are planning opportunities when you go from filing a joint return to a single return, as well as before that event happens. And so that's really what we're talking about with the widow's tax penalty.
Knowing that's coming, what should people do?
Right. So we look at individuals throughout their careers and look for places of time that are opportunities. So, for instance, somebody who might retire early, we would deem retiring early as before collecting Social Security or other sources of retirement income, maybe in a really low tax bracket in those years, and they might be very excited about paying low taxes. We may look at that as an opportunity to say, in future years, you're definitely going to be in a higher tax bracket. Let's look at some considerations for this, let's just call it a few-year window, to potentially think about things like Roth conversions or recognizing capital gains on some appreciated investments during that period of time.
Well, let's just walk through some of the basics. If the husband precedes the wife in death, and 80% of the time that happens,
right,
she loses usually a lot of income, right? Her husband's maybe Social Security. Some retirement plans are set up so that you now get 50%, depending on how it was set up, right? You maybe 75%, maybe 25%. But a lot of income falls off the table, right?
Not necessarily. So if there are investment assets or your retirement accounts, those aren't lost. And so you find yourself in a situation where that retirement income, right, which an IRA, we know we have to take required minimum distributions at some point in the future, that surviving spouse at 72, the IRS says you have to take a certain amount out of that account. Well, when she then starts to take money out of that account and she files as a single filer, she is going to be in an accelerated income bracket at a much lower income rate. Married filers have preferential treatment in terms of, you know, they can earn more money and be in the same tax bracket as a single filer. And so that's where the opportunity comes in. But if there's a loss of earned income, absolutely, John, you're right, then, you know, then the income would be cut because it wouldn't be household income.
Yeah, I mean, I recall filling out some pension plans, or one little pension that I have, and how much of it do you want to get while you're alive, and how much would be there if you pass before your spouse? And you know, you want to enjoy the money, but then you don't want your spouse to not have as much money, so it's a calculation, isn't it?
Right, that's called the survivor benefit for a pension, and so you would look at that and, you know, for your situation, look at a combination of a lot of different factors, right? You look at maybe your health, you look at your spouse's health, you look at other investment assets that you have and put that together in a plan that makes sense for your household. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
But the widow's tax penalty that we're talking about isn't germane to that, though, is it?
It's not.
Yeah.
No.
Right. And so then what should our listeners do specifically about this now, other than calling a professional, maybe like yourself, but I mean, where does their money go, or what should they be doing now?
Yeah, so with our clients, and as a part of the widow's practice group, right? We work with clients who are married before, you know, one spouse dies, or we might be in a situation where you know, somebody hires us after a spouse dies, and you know, if you have young kids at home, you may be able to file a joint or, you know, a qualifying widower return for a couple years. And so these are real opportunities after somebody dies. But we would look at things like windows of time where you may be able to do a Roth conversion prior to retirement, or, like I said, accelerating income. And also just being mindful of income that is recognized on your tax return where you can. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, Medicare premiums are based on income, and widows file as a single filer and really get penalized for that. So we need to be very cognizant of the amount of income that goes on a tax return if we can plan for that.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you about that. And, again, I'm not in this position yet, so some of this sounds a little foreign to me. but a widow's Medicare premium may increase because their spouse preceded them?
So what happens is that your Medicare premiums are based on your income, and they calculate them differently for an individual filer than for a married filer. And so, as an example, if there's an individual filer who earns $150,000 a year versus a joint filer who earns $150,000 a year, that individual may pay more than a couple hundred dollars more per month for their Medicare premiums. And so just being mindful of what that looks like on their tax return for things that we might be able to control for them.
This is related maybe tangentially, but the common advice is to delay as long as possible your receiving Social Security, right?
Right. So you can delay your Social Security to your age 70. You can't wait any longer than that. They make you take it at age 70, but yeah. So every year that you delay your Social Security, it continues to grow, right? So that's a return on that investment. And so again, right, we're talking about longevity, how long we're all going to live, death. We don't know that. We don't know how long we're all going to live. But at our firm, what we do is we take a lot of things into consideration for our clients. And one of those things are taking a real look at our health to say, okay, what's the longevity like then in my family, or what is my health like? Because if you told me how long you were going to live, John, I could tell you when to collect Social Security, but
well,
we don't know that.
Well, no kidding. And what's the earliest age at which you can begin to receive it?
Well, your full retirement age is around 66 right now.
Yeah.
And so you could take it a little bit earlier than that. We would not recommend that clients do that.
You do. You can get the money, but then it's going to be less. And if you can just wait a little bit longer, it will be substantially more. And the idea is then to live long enough to realize the difference, to appreciate the savings, right?
Exactly. I know a lot of people have that mindset of, I've paid into this, I want to get my money out of it at this point now, but the reality and what we're looking at with a lot of our clients and a lot of the things that we're studying right now as a firm are that people are living longer, and people who have sources of income and investment assets have access to good health care, they're living even longer. And so that's just a reality of what's going on within our society and something we spend a lot of time talking about and studying. And so by delaying it, if that does come to fruition, we all do live longer, you'd have been better off waiting to collect your Social Security.
Dave Deschamps is the wealth manager and head of the Widows Practice Group at Balassa D'Inverno Foltz. And the website is bdflc.com. Did I get that right?
Yes. Yeah, bdflc.com. And we've got a lot of good literature and information on our website for your listeners that want to go and take a look.
That makes better sense. bdflc.com.
Yeah.
bdflc.com. Dave, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thank you, John.
You bet. Take care. Cloudy skies downtown Chicago, but some sun is sneaking through, and it always is, you know, during the day. You have daylight. And I say that to say this. Here's Chris Gerst. Chris Gersh is the founder and CEO of RX Sun and Verde Solutions. You can visit verdesolutions.com. We're going to talk a little bit about solar power in the state of Illinois. Hi, Chris. Welcome to WGN. How are you?
John, doing great. I've been listening to you. I'm born and raised here in Chicago since the 90s. So
wow.
Great to finally be able to speak to you.
I'm sorry that it's taken you and I this long to get together. I know a little bit about your business. I was telling some members of the staff here that when I was in Minnesota, I did commercials for solar panels that would go on people's roofs. And they said,
yes, sir.
Up in Minnesota, where it seems like there's not that much daylight and it's cold, will they work? And son of a gun, they worked. And if it works in Minnesota, it should work in Illinois, right?
Yes, sir, 100%. And actually, if you look across the pond to Europe, they have more implementations in Germany and than Illinois, and it's a lot, believe it or not, more cloud cover over there. And here in the States, we really this past year hit a precipice where it's actually cheaper to install solar panels, the energy generated, cost per kilowatt installed than if you were to do any other sort of energy, including, gas or coal powered. So renewable energy is not just the right thing to do anymore. It's the cheaper thing to do, which is pretty exciting.
Are there incentives for people to Does the government underwrite the cost of putting the panels on your roof?
Right. So the federal government actually has there's some exciting news that came out of the CARES Act. They actually extended what's known as an investment tax credit. So individuals that install, whether it be businesses or individual homes, would actually receive a 26% investment tax credit on when they file their taxes the year that solar system goes into service. That's a federal tax credit. And then Illinois actually had an amazing, really nationally leading program where they would actually pay you what's called a solar renewable energy credit up front. It's upfronting you a payment of 15 years of solar production. And that was an actual check that you would receive. And that would account for approximately 30 to 35% of the total system costs. So with those two incentives, you would end up, in some cases, paying up to 50 to 60% of a total project cost, which is, typically around $30,000. So pretty great incentives. Unfortunately, that state incentive has ran out just a couple weeks ago.
So what does that mean? Is there any chance we can renew that? It would just seem to me like that would be a good place to put state dollars.
Yes, sir. Actually, after 75,000 jobs were created, as part of the it's called FEJA, Future and Energy Jobs Act was created, you saw a huge, and I'm sure you see them just driving down the road, solar panels popping up here and there, and it's created a tremendous amount of jobs. And the General Assembly can act quickly, hopefully, in the lame duck section and pass something that hopefully puts more money in the coffers to keep some of us employers such as Verde Solutions and ARCS on keeping our people on staff. But yeah. It's unfortunately been a it really took the wind out of our sails the last couple weeks.
RX Sun and Verde Solutions, VerdeSolutions.com. Yep. So do you do then residential or businesses or both?
Yeah, we do both. Separate businesses do. So Verde Solutions, for example, we're building that big College of Lake County project, the community college up there, both a ground and a roof mount. It's where you put them on the ground and on the roof. And that's great. It's a great prevailing wage job that we're able to, employ a lot of local labor and, engineers and things like that. And then RX Sun is our residential branch. We keep them separate just because of the marketing and different things that we do. But RX Sun, we actually donate 1,000 meals for every home solar system we install. And RX Sun is we're kind of trying to heal our communities and by going green. So RXSun.com is where you can find more information on that company.
Just last thing here, you said it took the wind out of our sails. Are you referring to the loss of the state stimulus then?
Yes, sir. So without the state stimulus, it doesn't necessarily. What's great about solar right now is that there's a lot of financing packages where people don't have to put any money out of pocket to get these solar systems, and there's a lot of companies that offer financing. And with those state incentives, what's great about it is typically, and this is how we like to design our systems, is that the monthly financing payment is often less than the amount of projected funds that you're going to save on your energy bill. So you're basically going for zero money out of pocket. You're able to go solar at your home, and you're actually projected over the year to save more money than the financing cost. So it's a real no-brainer. Without those state incentives, that decision, unfortunately, it's going to be more expensive than the financing cost, and it's just an uphill battle to build those projects.
So what do? Call my state legislator and say I want you to support residential solar. Well, I guess this would be commercial too, but we want the state to help support solar power, right?
Yes, sir, John. There's two bills out there. There's a path to 100. The governor ran on a path to get us to 100% powered by renewable energy. Right now we're at 6 or 7%. So the path to 100 really allows us to put funds into those coffers. And that legislation is going to take a little while, but emergency stop order to, you know, fund the adjustable block program, is what, you know, they should do, and people should call their state reps. There's also the Clean Energy Jobs Act. So both of those acts are, those bills are being pushed forward by different representatives. Both do a great job of comprehensively looking at the industry and making sure that, you know, jobs are created through this legislation. So either one of those, definitely call your rep and say, I want to help the solar industry, so let's get you voting green.
Yeah, no kidding. By the way, we've got to run, but is it a conceivable scenario where somebody would be generating more power on their roof or on their property than they're actually using, that they would net a positive for a billing cycle?
So that's a fantastic question. Yes, you're allowed to build up to 110% of your projected usage, and the sun hours change. So you're going to produce, if you have a system that's projected to produce over 110%, up to 110% of your usage for the year,
yeah,
those months of April, May, and June, you're going to have, you're going to be generating more. But unfortunately, ComEd and Ameren, they don't write you a check. They just, you know, you build up those credits, and then every April, they kind of wash those out. But to your point, you can be overproducing what you're going to use in any given month.
You know how that little meter goes around when you're using electricity? This guy sent me a video or picture. I don't recall exactly how he communicated this to me, but he said the little thing was going the other way. It was actually
spins backwards, yeah.
Yeah, I know, and it was a thrilling thing to see. It's like, holy cow. And then when somebody would turn on the washer or dryer, it might slow down, but you could literally monitor your energy use, and the idea that the sun is helping you and it shines all day long is a very compelling way to imagine.
It's the cheapest fuel out there, John. It's the cheapest
power.
Fuel. And it will spin the meter backwards, and ComEd will give you dollar-for-dollar credit for whatever you're paying for your energy, whatever you put back onto the grid. So you don't need batteries. It's not necessary. We can install those or EV charging station if you need it. But that being said, just the solar panels in itself does a great job of lowering your costs and helping out your community.
Chris Gersh, here's the website, verdesolutions.com, V-E-R-D-E as in green, verdesolutions.com. Okay, Chris, good luck to you.
Thank you, John.
Have a good day. It's 12:44. Let's get you more business news. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Several corporate leaders are among the 200 across the country telling Congress to certify President-elect Joe Biden's electoral victory. They delivered a letter yesterday urging a smooth transition of power as President Trump and many Republicans dispute his election defeat. Edelman Public Relations President and CEO Richard Edelman, Guggenheim Partners Executive Chairman Alan Schwartz, and Accenture CEO Julie Sweet are among those signing on to the letter. Democrats and some other Republicans say the process has run its proper course through local vote counts and recounts and court challenges. Chicago-based snack foods maker Mondelez International is buying the part of chocolate bar maker Hue that it doesn't already own. The Wall Street Journal reports the deal would value Hue at $340 million. Mondelez, which makes Oreo cookies among other snack foods, took a minority stake in Hue in 2019. Hue makes a popular chocolate bar based on the paleo diet that's vegan and free of soy and refined sugar. It also makes grain-free crackers. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Let's spend some time with Amy Guth. Hi, Amy. Welcome back.
Hi, John. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. This is very confusing for me because it just seems like it's difficult to keep track of what platforms are offering what programming. And it looks like at least this Viacom-CBS deal makes the Hulu Plus live TV option more attractive, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've been very interested to watch all the moves from streaming, especially this year as more people are using streaming instead of like going to theaters and things like that. I think this is very interesting. So Hulu and Viacom-CBS, as you said, have made a distribution deal. And so a lot of really popular cable channels are now going to be available through Hulu, their live TV options. So we're talking about like Nickelodeon, MTV Classic, Paramount Network, VH1, Comedy Central, BET Her, TV Land, like a lot of really big stations. So it's 14 new channels all in coming to Hulu's live TV service. So that certainly ups the game kind of in these streaming wars when people are kind of going, well, do I go with this service or this one? And I think most people have kind of a combination of them. But that certainly ups the ante for Hulu in a very, very big way. Hulu Plus Live TV is the bigger of the two. They have 4.1 million subscribers. YouTube TV has about 3 million subscribers. So, you know, we're still talking about some pretty big numbers here when we're talking about moving subscribers and things like that. But this is a very big deal. Similarly to that, you and I have talked about Quibi before, which is a service that was launched meant to be watched on your phone, and it very, you know, had very bad timing with the pandemic. So it was supposed to be consumed in very small 5 to 9 minute chunks while you were waiting in line or waiting in a waiting room, things like that. And with people not out in the world, it closed after just 6 months after, you know, after having raised a ton of money, had some really big names attached to it, but also some moves from Quibi, and that they have there's some talk that they are in talks with Roku to acquire all of that stuff. Quibi raised $1.7 billion from major Hollywood studios and some other investors when they launched. So they backed a ton of content, and when they closed in such a short time, there was this question of, well, what's going to happen? All these shows, they had some big names attached to it. They had really invested in a lot of production. And so that's going to potentially be available on Roku, which kind of ups the stakes for Roku. So kind of an interesting day to watch all the streaming news today.
Quibi was short programs, right?
Yeah, yeah, they were meant to be really short, like watching on your phone when you were in line at the grocery store.
Right.
The idea that, you know, each like while you were in line at the grocery store, you could watch one episode, then you went to Target, you could watch another while you were, you know, waiting in traffic, maybe you watched another, things like that. They were kind of built on this idea that people are busy and they're running around and we're mostly consuming stuff on our phones. Of course, all that changed with the pandemic and people were back to larger format viewing,
and
watching on TVs and laptops again.
Weren't people surprised that, okay, so the timing was fantastically awful for them. It was the perfect storm. The idea is that people actually had plenty of time to watch unending things. They didn't need micro TV shows. And now all of a sudden we had all of the time in the world to watch longer form stuff. So they pulled the plug on it. I just wonder, though, if maybe the appetite for that kind of Quibi programming will come back, that those sorts of shows will find a place in 2022 or something like that.
Yeah, I wonder the same thing. I had the exact same thought that it, you know, especially with Jeffrey Katzenberg and Meg Whitman,
yeah,
who are at the helm of Quibi. I mean, here's some really big trusted names in that industry, and with so much money that they raised, you kind of hate to see it go if maybe there's an appetite for it on the other side of the pandemic. Time will tell. It'll be interesting to see what happens to that content. If it does show up on Roku, is that, you know, a leg that Roku has up on everybody else once
mm-hmm.
this is over and people are back in the world again? It will be very interesting to see.
Does that mean, though, that it's not going to be new production, but rather they've just taken that stuff and repositioned it on this other platform?
Yeah, pretty much. That's the word for now. We'll see if the deal goes through, we'll see what details emerge. But from what I understand, the reporting around it is that it's going to be what's already been produced, because so many things were in production. I mean, we had some really big names attached to it. Chrissy Teigen was doing a show. There was a lot of people doing a lot of stuff. They're, you know, big stars. So rather than just kind of chuck that all out, that gives people a way to watch it and still view it and participate in that. But I too have the same questions about what happens to this smaller format when, you know, you can't really unring a bell. Once people are back in the world again, we kind of know that that existed once upon a time and might have an appetite for it again.
30 seconds. Talk to me about the study from the Van Lines company about where Illinoisans are going.
Such an interesting study. So United Van Lines and its competitor, Atlas Van Lines, both do annual reports. And they reported in their studies that 66.4% of the interstate moves in 2020 that were handled in Illinois, 66.4% of them for United were outbound, and 63% of them from Atlas were also outbound. So it's kind of taking a look at, we've been seeing population loss over the years. This is kind of a way to measure the state's seventh year of population loss, when we're seeing that roughly two-thirds of all interstate moves that are happening connected to Illinois are outbound.
49th out of 50 states for that phenomenon. Not good for Illinois. Pay attention to that, lawmakers. Okay, thanks, Amy Guth. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. WGN Radio News is next.